Today is Friday, June 30th, 2006. My name is Sandy Fahler. I am an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today I am interviewing Elizabeth Craig, Professor of Biochemistry and current chair of the UW-Madison Department of Biochemistry. Good morning.
Good morning.
Let's start this interview with your childhood. If you could talk about where and when you were born, talk about your childhood and your early schooling, talk about your family, any family members or teachers or others who encouraged you in your studies when you were in elementary school and high school.
I was born in outside of a small town in New Hampshire, town of about 1,500, one older brother. Both my parents were involved in elementary education as professions, so education was always an important thing. And probably one of the most important things was both my parents, and particularly my mother, well, no, my father also, was anything my brother got to do, I got to do too. So I wanted to learn how to play baseball. My father taught me how to play baseball. When someone called up to see whether or not, you know, my brother wanted some money mowing lawns and he wasn't available, my mother suggested maybe I did, because that, you know, paid five times more than babysitting at the time.
Right.
So in that subtle level, I sort of grew up thinking, okay, you know, I can do that. And when I look back, I think that was really important. It was very subtle, but it was very important. And I can remember listening from upstairs, hearing an argument, not really an argument, but a discussion between my parents, and it was thought that I should go to teacher's college, and my mother was arguing, no, I should be able to go to university like my brother. And, I mean, I wouldn't be here if I had gone to the local teacher college. So that was, a very important decision. So I feel like I had been supported in childhood and for education very well.
Did you like science as a child?
I loved science as a child. I was just interested in it. And I think the luckiest thing that probably happened to me was the two science teachers I had in high school. And my graduating class was 50 students from seven different towns. So this was a very small rural school. For whatever reason, both were young men who eventually went on and got PhDs and actually taught in colleges, but took a few years off and taught high school science. And one taught biology and set up a special advanced biology class for five of us. And I even had a calculus class by television in 1964, taught by Miss Hancock, who was, you know, just ready to retire, and it came from a professor at the university. So I was enormously well prepared, remarkably so, from a town that size. And so I feel very fortunate that happened.
So then you had to make a decision on where you were going to go to college, and were encouraged to go to the university by your mother.
Right. And I did not want to go to the University of New Hampshire. I mean, I actually had a hard time, I think, especially in that time in small towns, with peers in high school and being smart and an athletic girl. I mean, I was what everyone would call a tomboy, back then, and I played every sport. And
what was your favorite sport?
My favorite sport was basketball. I lived for basketball.
Now, in those days, did you play full court basketball?
No, we played half court with Rovers.
Oh, yes. I remember Rovers.
The three dribble rule.
And you still thought it was your favorite sport?
It was fun, yeah. I loved it, you know. Yeah. But I loved tennis, too. I learned to play tennis.
Mm-hmm.
So I, you know, I. But it wasn't an easy high school. And the thought of going off to college with some of my high school classmates was just not something that, I felt real
good
about.
Right.
So I ended up going what I thought at the time was very far away, which was the University of Rhode Island, which was actually 110 miles from home. but it gave me the anonymity that I sort of craved at that point. And so there I went.
And did you choose that mainly because it was a little further away from home, or were there other reasons?
Not really. It was like a blind. Then my other choice, and just because these are the three places I applied for, the University of New Hampshire, the University of Maine, and the University of Rhode Island. I mean, in my family background, one would never have considered applying to a private school. I mean, those were like off the social radar screen. Mm-hmm. So those were three universities. And I think I got a full scholarship to the University of Maine. And just a little scholarship to Rhode Island. And the more I thought about it, though, I didn't want to go to the boonies. I mean, I lived in the, Rhode Island was the boonies, but relative to Orono, Maine, it was not the boonies. And so that was a big family issue. But I had a summer job that I could make quite a bit of money, and I was able to pay most of my way through college.
What was your summer job?
This is the other thing that happened that made me be where I am now. So in this little tiny town, there is the McDowell Artist Colony, which was set up by Edward McDowell. It was his summer farm from living in New York. And 30 artists, painters, writers came in and had, you know, little sabbaticals there. And my father didn't want me to work there because he thought I'd get in trouble. And there was some validity in my concern. I was a waitress and dishwasher and so forth there for my 4 years. And my summer after high school and my 4 years through college. And I worked overtime and various things. And it actually paid fairly well. But I also got to interact with all of these people. Completely opened my eyes to all sorts of things.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, when you enrolled at the University of Rhode Island, did you have an idea what you wanted to pursue, what field?
I put down my major as biology. So I clearly had some sort of idea what I was interested in. And that came from the teachers I had in high school.
Mm-hmm. Well, talk about that experience, your undergraduate experience. Was it a positive one? The right choice as far as you're concerned?
Yeah, overall, I think the university worked very well for me. I made a decision, and I can't believe I was that astute, 19 years old. I first majored in biology, and so I took my zoology courses. And it was lacking something for me. And the way I would sort of felt about it, it was mushy. And I took one microbiology course, and I said, this is what I like this so much better. And it was the fact that you could ask different types of questions instead of sort of doing anatomy and looking at something. With microbiology at that time, it was, 15 or so, 20 years after the first molecular experiments had been done. And so it was is a much more molecular type of analysis, not quite what we consider today. And so I switched my major to bacteriology. But then I was worried about a job. And so I decided I was going to major in medical technology. And then I got to my senior year, and you had to go away to Providence and do a year of internship. And I thought, I don't really want to do this. So I stepped back from that and just became a plain old bacteriology major. And I don't know why, I do not recall why I did this, I started doing research in a lab. I can't remember how the opportunity came about, but I did it, and that was it. I found my love, and then the most important thing is I was talking to my advisor Paul Cohen, and he asked me what I was going to do, and I said, well, I've got to find a job, and I don't have any money, and I can still see myself standing in his office, and he said, they pay you to go to graduate school. what? And I said, okay. And I had no, you know, my generation, no thought. I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to become a professor, or I'm going to, you know, do this or that. It was so I could keep doing this and make enough money to live. So
why not?
Why not? And so that then I applied to graduate school.
And where did you apply?
For no reason. I did, again, sort of this life-changing decision. So I had lived in a town of 1,500, and I had gone to the University of Rhode Island. The school had like 5,000, and the town has a population of about 1,500. And I was afraid of cities. And I thought, I should go to graduate school in a city. If I don't go to live in a city, I'll never, you know what I mean? I'll spend the rest of my life avoiding cities. And so I applied to Johns Hopkins, Case Western Reserve, and the University of Washington in St. Louis. And I ended up going to, did I say the University of Washington? If anybody's a Washington University alum, I'm sorry, Washington University in St. Louis. I chastise other people for that.
Uh-huh.
And so I made the decision to go to WashU.
And what kind of package did you get?
I think it was $1,800 stipend.
And that was good.
That was
all
great. I mean, I had, especially because of this deal with my parents, I mean, I had had no money.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had no money in college. I mean, buying a new tube of toothpaste was, you know, an exciting shopping experience. And so this to me seemed, I had no problem. You know, this was not, and there was health insurance. You know,
sure.
So
now, what was their reaction to your decision to go to graduate school and to go to the big city?
Not so great. You know, they didn't really understand. I mean, I wanted to do it, so that's okay, but it was a long ways away, and, you know, they were in some ways disappointed, in some ways proud, but they didn't quite understand what I was doing.
Well, talk about your graduate experience. Were there people that influenced you there and put you in the direction that you wanted to go in, or you?
Yes, the first couple of years were very painful. I mean, this decision in theory was very good. In practice, it was a very painful experience, and I almost dropped out of graduate school initially.
What happened?
I was homesick. Oh. I mean, and I couldn't. I mean, this city. I mean, I lived in a dorm that had six floors on it, and it took me a month and a half to figure out that there were actually buttons on the elevator to push to go upstairs, because I had never been in an elevator before, so I used to just stand there and wait. You know, so I mean, this is
right.
Sort of the level that
right.
that I was at. So it took me a good year to start feeling comfortable in that situation. I joined one research lab, and that turned into a not very good experience, and I changed lab. And I landed in the lab with the most wonderful man, David Schlesinger. And he really helped me develop into a scientist. And I remember this with my, you know, students. He would sort of bring me into his office and talk to me. I had no clue what he was talking about for the first, you know what I mean?
Sure.
Numbers of months. And then gradually we started having a conversation. And I remember when I couldn't start writing my first paper, and he said, well, why aren't you writing this? And I said, I just don't know how to start. The next day he came in with this rough draft and just handed it to me.
Now, did he find you or did you find him? And how did you connect with him?
He was in the same department, and my advisor over the first 2 years had gone to a Gordon conference, which are small scientific Gordon conferences, and apparently had talked about my work. And he didn't tell me that, and David who was in the same department came up to me and he said, you know, your advisor talked about the work and people were really excited about it. And so, you know, that made me feel really good, but on the other hand, it was like, that was sort of like, to me, this isn't going anywhere because, you know, I didn't even know that, you know what I mean, that my advisor had done this, and we don't probably need to go into all of those stories, but it became, you know, clear that this was not going to help me get anywhere. And so when I made that decision, he was one of the people that I went to and said, can I join your lab? So I had known him from that interaction.
And what were you working on?
I was working on messenger RNA degradation in bacteria, in E. coli as a model system. So I had stuck with the microbiology. I had applied to microbiology graduate programs.
And so from that point on then, graduate school was a success.
Graduate school was a success. I was happy.
And you were going right for your PhD.
Yes. That was right at the time that most biology or molecular biology type programs that were starting up did not have any master's degrees.
I see. And talk about the dissertation process. How does that work in the sciences?
In the sense?
Well, your dissertation is based on your research, correct?
Right.
And did your research change over the years that you were in graduate school?
Well, fortunately for me, that the lab that I was first in and the lab that I was second in, their fundamental problems they were working on were very similar.
I see.
Okay. So I did not have to drastically change what I was thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
So that was really good.
Mm-hmm.
You develop a research project and you carry out experiments and you write a paper and then you take those results and try to make it, you know, build on them, ask another question, get the results so you can write another paper, and then you write all that up in as your thesis. And
did you know early on that you wanted to continue in academia, or hadn't you really made that decision? I mean, were you looking for a teaching job, research job in university?
I was clueless. I was looking for nothing. I mean, the idea that I would become a professor had never entered my head. I probably thought of myself more as the model that I could see is people working as technicians in labs. I could certainly... So that, I think, I thought was what I would do for a long time. So then, of course, you graduate, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I got my degree in 4 years, which even then was fairly short period of time, and you don't know much after 4 years. And in the meantime, I had gotten married, and my husband was graduating, my then husband was graduating from medical school. And the possibility, in a sense, of, especially at that, with the mentality of the times, of finding something in the same cities and so forth, it was just impossible. And we ended up making the decision to stay in St. Louis for his internship and so forth. So I found a postdoc position in the same city.
And how long were you there?
I have to think here. 3 years it must have been, about 3 years.
And then what happened?
And then, I took a wonderful 6-month hiatus that never shows up on my CV, which was a bicycle trip throughout Europe for 6 months, which was, I'm so glad, you know, I always encourage people to do something like that if they can.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was residency for my husband, and he grew up in California, and would want to go back there for at least a while. And so I looked around the San Francisco Bay Area, and I actually moved into the postdoc at UCSF, University of California, San Francisco. And, you know, applied for a fellowship and got one. And so...
So you at that point, though, you still... Did you have an idea what you wanted to do once you were...
No.
You just knew...
I knew I liked doing what I was doing.
Uh-huh.
And I had been doing... Clearly, I'd been doing well because I was getting these fellowships. So I could get a fellowship that would pay enough money. We had one child by that time. And there was some flexibility that came with being a postdoc that doesn't come with a real job. Like, you can leave at 2 p.m. or change your working hours to whatever you want. And so it fit, you know, the situation very well. But no idea back had not occurred to me at all.
Now, with the postdoc, is that primarily research, or do you do some teaching too?
In our type of business, it's and you have a fellowship, it's all research.
It's all research, yeah.
So I had done a small amount of teaching when I was a graduate student, but not very much. I was in the medical school, so there were not undergraduates there. So I had TA'd part of a medical student lab at one point. Not a particularly enjoyable experience, but...
Was it after San Francisco then that you came to Wisconsin?
Yes, so So I don't know why, at some point, had my second child, and I don't honestly remember this whole thing. So then there had to be a discussion. Residency was ending, for my husband, and so it was time to sort of grow up and have a real job. And... So where were we going to go? Where were we going to end up? And somehow, I think the person whose lab I was working in San Francisco said, "Well, aren't you going to apply for faculty positions?" And I was like, "Oh, do you think I could?" And it seemed like a good idea, and my husband was sort of game, and so I applied to a bunch of places, and he looked into, physician-type jobs in those places. And I got offered interviews everywhere I applied for.
And that surprised you?
Oh, it shocked me, because mm-hmm. I had never thought about this.
Sure.
In retrospect, if I look at it, it's totally understandable. I mean, I was in the fortunate position that three or four young scientists on the job market that year that knew how to do recombinant DNA. And I was one of those. So when I'd moved to San Francisco, I had gone into a lab that was like one of two in the country that were just starting recombinant DNA. And I learned that, and I perfected part of the technology. So, I mean, if I look at it now, it's like, duh. But to me,
So how did you choose Wisconsin?
I still didn't like big cities a lot. I mean, I love San Francisco, but in general, I had two little kids. I couldn't imagine, for example, raising those kids, any kids, and having a job like being, you know, a professor in a large city. That was important to have an environment. I did not want to move to a place. I've been thinking about this after I finally applied for the jobs, that if I did well enough that I felt that I was having fun and being successful, that the tenure was an issue. So I turned down a job you at Johns Hopkins. I turned down a job interview at Yale. I didn't apply to Harvard. You know, I mean, I made a very conscious decision not to go there. And, I mean, I knew Wisconsin had, you know, excellent science and so forth, but I knew, you know, there was one slot, one person. If you did well, you would get tenure. It wasn't three slots, three people, one slot, which is what happens.
I see.
You know, some other places.
What was the interview process like here?
So I was not in this department at the time. I interviewed in the department of what is then called physiological chemistry in the medical school, which is the other biochemistry department on campus. And so it's actually quite similar to what an interview would be now. I mean, come in, you have a discussion with every faculty member or most faculty members in the department. You present a seminar of your work and present a roundtable discussion with the faculty of where your research is going. And you can tell I'm deciding whether or not to tell a story. And I think I'll tell a story.
Okay.
So the former chair of that department, who's a very, very respected scientist, P.P. Kahn, was sitting around the table and one of the ones that was interviewing me. And at the end of this, he says, "Well, my guess is we should let Dr. Craig go. Dr. Craig looks a little tired. She probably needs to take a nap. Do you usually take a nap in the afternoon?" And it just happened to be that I actually knew his son quite well. And his son, I had heard many, many stories about P.P. Cohen and how tough a guy he was and so forth. And his son, who was actually in medical school, you know, and when I was in St. Louis, was much more of a laid-back guy. So, you know, this was the 60s. And, you know, and I looked at him and I said, "No, I don't, but I think Milt does." So I walked out of this room saying, "I don't, you know." I just thought it was so inappropriate, and I don't know what possessed me to say this, because, I mean, I didn't have to have this job, you know? I got the job. But it was a very foolish thing to say. It was a foolish thing for him to say, too. Yeah.
And so you knew right away that you wanted to come here, and you...
No, in fact, I didn't. I left not interested, which is probably the reason that I said that. And the reason was, is that's a very small department, and when I interviewed, I only talked to people in that department. So at that point, I didn't know very much about Wisconsin, and I came away with the idea that this is a very small place. But I was walking down the hall at UCSF, and a person named Christine Guthrie was a faculty member there, and stopped me in the hall and said, "Oh, I heard you interviewed at Wisconsin. It's a great place," because she had gotten her degree at the Enzyme Institute. And I sort of looked at her and I said, "Really?" And then she sort of talked about it. So then when the call came that, you know, "Want you to come back for a second visit," I said yes, and I made it an issue of talking to other people on campus when I came back. But when I left, no, I actually had no interest in coming here.
So what year was it when you came here?
I came here in 79.
Did it take long to understand the culture of the department? Were you comfortable with it? Cooperative group, collaborative group? Was it easy to meet people in other departments and work with people in other departments?
Let me answer the second one.
Okay.
First. The answer to that one was yes. I mean, Jim Crow, bless his heart, sent me an email. No, he didn't send me an email, he sent me a letter.
That's right.
Welcoming me, because I was working on fruit flies at that time, and of course Jim Crow, mm-hmm. that's his thing. And so, in a sense, I was welcomed into the Drosophila, the fruit fly community, and that was wonderful. And you know, it was just a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. Fitting into the department was harder. There were no other women in the department. That made it, you know, a little difficult. I give the chair at the time, Harry Karavolis, enormous credit. I mean, he tried very hard to treat me like everyone else, you know, and I can remember the first time we were going through a door and he started to let me go through and he walked through. And he called every faculty member by their last name and he called me Craig. And the first, you know what I mean, the first few times it was like, but then I really appreciated it, right? Because he was very, very hard to treat me like everyone else. And there were numbers of things that happened that I look back, I tried to decide, is this so uncomfortable because I'm a woman, or is it uncomfortable because that's the way assistant professors are treated? And after many years, I decided that a lot of it, and most of it, was that's how assistant professors were treated. But it was hard.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you came in, you had to do some negotiating, I'm assuming. Do you feel you did a good job?
Yeah. So they said something about equipment needs, so I reached into my pocket and I pulled out my list.
Smart.
And so I think I was very well prepared. And I can't remember, at UCSF, I think probably, I didn't really talk very much to my advisor, but there was a then young faculty member named Keith Yamamoto, who's, I think he's vice something or other now at UCSF, and he was a UCS postdoc, and he transitioned into a faculty position there, and so he was the person that I asked. He had gone around and gotten jobs at MIT and Harvard and so forth, so I went to him and said, what should I do? Yeah. And so he, you know, those conversations prepared me quite well. So I didn't feel like, I think a lot of people, especially women, sometimes feel that they're sort of clueless as to what to do mm-hmm. in the situation.
And how were the lab facilities?
For the time, I think, again, they weren't bad, but I inherited three rooms that was P.P. Cohen's retiring rooms, and he had been his space had been decreased in time, and so these three labs, when I walked in, were piled to the ceiling with ancient equipment. And so my job was to clean it out. And
how long did that take?
Well, I got one room working very rapidly. I had no office. I had to set up a little desk in the lab because they let P.P. Cohen kept his office, and it was right inside, essentially, my lab space.
Now, what building was that?
That's in like SMI and Bardeen, the old hospital building.
Okay, right.
Which was built in the 50s.
Yeah. Would you talk about the tenure process?
Yes, and for me, it was very easy. I got tenure within 4 years. Mm-hmm. I hardly thought about it. I'm blessed. I was very fortunate. My research just took off when I got here. I was able to bring, from the situation I was in at UCSF, I brought an ongoing project. A young postdoc that had joined that lab decided they wanted to come with me. They came 6 months later.
So you must have brought money with you then.
I wrote a grant before I came. Ah. So I spent all my startup, which weren't very big, in the first 6 months, and my grant started 6 months later. And I am a little organized, I guess, but I brought everything with me So, in fact, I did an experiment within 2 weeks of arriving in Madison. I even brought water, you know, because biochemical experiments can be dependent on water. So, in retrospect, I didn't consider myself organized, but I've actually never seen any Tibetans. But, you know, we're going to do this. I'm going to do it. And
we'll talk about your research. Has it changed over the years?
I'm still working on the biological problem I brought with me. And it's turned into, although I didn't know at that time, you know, an extremely interesting basic biological problem. So I feel I've been extremely lucky, because I started working on what was simply a phenomena, and been able to take it, not me myself, obviously, other labs work on it, and obviously people in the lab work on it, but bring it into something that's now in textbooks. Mm. And so that's been extremely fun.
Mm-hmm. Now, is the fruit fly still part of your research?
No, I changed from fruit fly, working on the same biological problem, I changed from fruit flies to yeast as a model system. I had both systems going for about 10 years, and then I decided it's just too much, I can't do it, and I've stuck mainly with the yeast system.
Mm-hmm. Would you talk about this, the biological problem that you're working on?
I'll try.
Okay.
So the phenomena that we started with was from an observation that someone had made in fruit flies back in the 60s, that if you do something bad to them, like increase the temperature or put a chemical on them, they could see, when they look at what's called polyene chromosomes, a huge strain change in structure. And that, a few years later, people figured out that this was an induction of transcription, and therefore new proteins being made. And I was interested in that initially because this is a nice system to study this sort of induction of gene regulation. And then we made an observation right before I came here that started to give the impression that, one, these proteins were not made just in these times of stress. There were related proteins there all the time. And the most startling to me was that these proteins had been conserved. At that point, that first observation was in San Francisco, and then in my first 6 months here, we found that those proteins were very similar in fruit flies and in yeast. And then in another few months, we found that they're also in bacteria. And that now would be, oh, okay. But back in 82, that was shocking. And what it said to me as fundamentally a biologist is these have to be doing something incredibly important, because they wouldn't be in everything. And so then my project became, what are these proteins that nobody knows anything about doing? And now we know that they're a protein which has the name molecular chaperone, because they're important for helping all the other proteins in the cell get into their final conformation. And back in 1972, a man named Anfison won the Nobel Prize for finding that as a protein is made, it's made in a linear chain. But in order to be functional, it has to get folded up into a very complex conformation. And he did the experiment that you take a protein, you unfold it, and it can go back into that same complex conformation, which there are hundreds of other ways that it could, you know, go into a three-dimensional structure. What our findings in our field is saying, yes, that's true under certain circumstances in a test tube, but once you get inside a cell, everything's much more complicated and much more constrained. That's not the way it happens. You have these other class of proteins that chaperones these newly synthesized proteins into their final conformation. And so that's a very fundamental thing. Mm-hmm. They're present in all, mm-hmm. in all cells. And what keeps this exciting, I think, is the fact that in the past few years, it's become clear that many of the neurological diseases, Huntington's disease, Parkinson's disease, are really protein folding diseases. They're diseases in which particular proteins, different in each case, fold incorrectly. And so there's a lot of interest in how these molecular chaperones proteins can alter those folding of those folding states and maybe even be used as some sort of treatment eventually for that. So that's how it's evolved over 25 years.
Has it, how easy is it or how difficult is it for you to get funding for your research?
Knock on wood. I've had the same two NIH grants since the first year and the third year that I've come. So they're in their 26th or 7th year. So I've been very, very, very fortunate. And I hope it continues.
Yeah, that isn't the story I normally hear. So you have been. Well, I think it's more than just being very fortunate, but.
Well, I've thought about how to do that, of course, but I feel fortunate as well.
Yeah. And your lab is next door, or mm-hmm. one of your labs? Is that you have more than one lab?
No, I have this lab, and then I have a parter lab across the hallway. But every part, all part, it's all on this floor.
And how many people are working in the lab?
16.
And are they're graduate students, postdocs, and scientists?
A combination.
Combination.
Yeah.
I see. So is that primarily how your research is funded, through the NIH?
Primarily. I have a grant from the Muscular Dystrophy Association as well.
Mm-hmm. Are there other scientists on other universities that are working on these same issues? And
yes.
Lots.
Yeah.
And do you do collaborative work with them?
I do with some, mm-hmm. yes.
What about on campus? Do you work collaboratively with other faculty?
Not so much, unfortunately. There are some areas that are more well represented than others, and mine is not particularly well represented. And that's one of the few regrets I have about Wisconsin, is it doesn't have people that sort of fit into that general area. Mm-hmm. So I wish there were more.
Mm-hmm. Now, you said that when you were doing graduate work, you didn't do a lot of teaching. Do you teach now, or have you taught since you came?
I have taught a lot. I became chair of biochemistry last year, and I had no time.
Yeah, sure.
So I do a seminar class and that sort of thing, but I dropped my classroom teaching.
Do you enjoy teaching?
I enjoy some teaching. I think I'm a clear teacher. I don't think I am a charismatic teacher. And that is sort of become, I think, more and more necessary as the years have progressed. So I have a hard time with large lectures. I get okay.
So do you teach undergraduates then too?
So I moved into biochemistry only four years ago. Okay, mm-hmm. So if I've been here 26 years, I was 22 years in the department in the medical school. And even though it's in the medical school, almost all my teaching was undergraduate teaching.
I see.
And mostly, well, and by definition, non-major teaching. Teaching biochemistry, all their favorite courses, to nursing students, medical technologists, physical therapists, to be students.
Now, what about the teaching you do with your graduate students and in the lab? That's more of a one-on-one.
That's more one-on-one.
Do you enjoy?
Let me tell you what my favorite class was, because it makes it sound like I don't like teaching at all. But I actually taught summer school to 25 students for the most basic level of biochemistry, where you don't need any, say, organic chemistry. And that was by far, I enjoyed that class tremendously. You taught them every day, it was like 25 people. You could get them to buy in. It was great. And in that class, a significant proportion were returning students. And you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They were interested. Mm-hmm. They wanted to understand something. And
what summer did you teach that?
Oh, I taught it from probably 83 through 90 something, every summer except maybe one or two. Mm-hmm. And
I have a nephew who came here for summer school. He decided he wanted to go back to dental school, and he had to get some basics. And he'd been going to San Jose State, I think, mm-hmm. and wasn't able to get organic chemistry when he needed it. So he came here to summer school and took that, and he just loved it. So you could have been his teacher.
I could. And it's funny. I took my child to the ER, and the person there was talking to me about biomolecular chemistry 314. You know. So I mean, that was very nice because you saw the students that sometimes really struggled in that class, and then you saw what they did in the ER and how they it was very rewarding. Uh-huh. You know, that you helped that person get to the state that they could do this.
Sure.
And not the people that go on to graduate school, not the people that become physicians.
Mm-hmm.
But, so that I, you know, that was to me a very rewarding
mm-hmm.
teaching.
I think you've touched on this, but what are the most significant developments in your field of study?
I think I have touched on that.
Pretty much what you were talking
about.
Right. What's being done right here.
Mm-hmm. And others.
Would you talk about your involvement in faculty governance, in committee work, and other campus activities, what you've enjoyed? I know you said you're department chair now. Maybe talk about that. What are the positive things about being the department chair? Are there any negative things to be the department chair?
I mean, the positive things are you can facilitate things. You can facilitate change, which is hopefully good. You can maybe get things to work better. Which can range from graduate programs to undergraduate education to anything. So I think if things work well, I mean, if you're effective, it's a really important position. You can help create a certain environment. It can be extremely frustrating and demanding and insomnia generating in the middle of the night. Because there's all of the, you know, everybody's problems, and you know, it can be overwhelming sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Now, did I read, you were a department chair in the medical school also?
So for 6 years I was a department chair in the biomolecular chemistry, alias physiological chemistry, from 96 to 2002.
Is there a big difference doing it now?
Well, the departments are very, very different. I mean, that's a small department, at the time, 10 faculty members in a medical school.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a faculty of 36. Associated with, you know, huge centers, the NMR Center, you know, Structural Biology Center, you know, a staff of 3 or 4 over there, a staff of 15 mm-hmm. over here. So I mean, they're so different in scope.
What about other activities on campus?
So recently, most of my energy actually has been in that level of thing. I mean, I was, you know, chair of the Biological Divisional Committee once.
What does that entail?
That's the main job of that committee, and although it did other things at the time, was sort of passing on tenure issues for the biological
mm-hmm.
division. So that was really the first thing that I did, and I didn't intend to do it. where it sort of put me in a position of having to lead something and having to deal with people on difficult issues.
Yeah, that must have been a stressful situation also.
So that was stressful, you know, in the sense that never having been in that sort of situation and sort of learning how can one do that and have it come out the best it possibly can. Mm-hmm.
Would you talk about the climate for women here, and how does it help or hinder the participation and advancement of women on the campus?
That's a hard question. I think the climate is not great, not bad. I think I think this is a really complex issue. And, one of the things I've struggled with over the last number of years is it's much easier if you're in a position as you're an advocate for, like, the climate is bad, the situation is bad, how can we make it better? And being in a situation of being a department chair where you have to be everyone's advocate. In some ways you can accomplish much more, but it's much harder to say, oh, the climate's terrible, or, oh, you're part of it, perhaps. But so I think it is a very complex, a complex issue. I think it is much better than it was 25 years ago. There are more women. I mean, there were very few women in biological sciences when I came. I remember in cell and molecular biology program that had 103 trainers. I was the third woman as a trainer in that program. But that doesn't mean we don't have a long way to go. And
Do you see yourself as a mentor?
Oh, sure. You know, I've talked, usually not formally, but I've been a mentor, certainly to the women who are hired in biomolecular chemistry. When I was still there, the faculty was 30% women. Well, that's only 3 out of 10.
That's good, but for a medical school.
That's pretty good. Mm-hmm. For a medical school. Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think their success is in part due to the fact that I mentored them. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Are there networks on campus for women to interact, particularly women in science?
Yes, I think there are. I mean, I think there's the Weissel opportunities are very helpful to younger women. I think there is enough of a critical mass of younger women faculty now where, you know, connections are made, and I can sort of see it, mm-hmm. see it happening. I mean, in some ways I was very fortunate because I came, Carol Gross got a faculty position, I think it was like year and a half after I did, and Judith Kimball, I think I was on her search committee, 3 years after it. And so those were the three people that I sort of talked to the most, and we all ended up in the National Academy. Mm-hmm. So it was and we didn't talk to each other all that much, but the fact that, you know what I mean, it really was a very nice core to sort of play things off of, because we all had pretty high standards, sure. and expectations. Mm-hmm. And so, although there were very few, I was pretty fortunate. I've seen a lot in the last 26 years or whatever it is. And I think the climate works well for a good portion of the women. But I think for a portion, find it very, very hard. And I think on average it's much, much easier for a young male to come in and find a place they're comfortable and deal with the structure and that sort of thing. And I think it's much, much harder for a really significant segment of women that come. I don't quite understand that. You know, I can't figure out what makes it harder and not. I mean, certainly I think you need a certain degree of flexibility and decide what you're going to let run off your back and what you're not and how to handle situations. And I think it's the better you are at that, the easier it is. Now, is that fair? Probably not. but it's the reality. And I don't know. I think the trick is how to get the group of women that it's not so easy for, how to really make it easier, mm-hmm. and how long it will take to have that happen.
Do you see more women coming into your program, into doing graduate work here?
I mean, yes, those numbers have increased dramatically over the last 15 years. Of course, what hasn't so much increased is going from the postdoc type of position to going into faculty positions.
But why is that?
I think it's a number of reasons. One is the reality is that it's not easy, right? I mean, the balance of family and professional life is not an easy one. And I see a lot of women just not wanting to do it. You know? Life decision. And, you know, I can't blame them. So I still think there's this big divide. I mean, there's the number of women like myself who are just obsessed, right? They love this stuff. And they're fine. And then there's another group that's pretty good. You know, it can do that and are really, really interested in doing it. And then there's another group that likes science and likes doing this sort of stuff, but no, they want balance, more balance in their life. Mm-hmm. And that group is never going to be part of academia unless academia somehow changes. And, you know, childbearing years are either during your graduate years, your postdoc years, or your assistant professor years. There's no... Right? No getting away, getting around it. So, yeah.
I'm going to finish this interview by asking you about your balance in your life. But first, I wanted, if you would talk a little bit about the awards and honors that you've received. I know you mentioned about the National Academy of Sciences. If you could talk about that experience, and then others that you'd like to share.
Well, for me personally, that's the one that has meant by far the most to me. And it has been, I think, the most important professionally for me. It's sort of like the gold seal of approval or something, you know, like, you've done well, and you do really good science, and it's nice. It's very nice. And I think professionally for me, I'm actually a shy person, and I don't, it's hard for me to put myself forth, particularly in groups and in somewhat difficult situations. And being a member of the National Academy, you say something to a provost or something, and that's a better chance that they'll listen. And so that gives one more of a voice that is listened to when trying to get what important issues that you think they're important, that where change should occur, and so forth. And I've mentioned this to other, particularly women, and they say, yep.
And what was the experience like when you were elected and... What was the experience like? Do you go through a ceremony?
You go through a ceremony. And that was actually not very exciting. You know, I mean, you walk up on a stage and you sign a big book. And you have to worry about what you're going to wear. So to me, that, you know, that was okay. That was the pomp and circumstance. I mean, when you find out, you know, that's the experience. And I found out 10 minutes before I needed to give a 2-hour lecture. And it was interesting because I was trying to figure out how to get some of this active learning things into this sort of session. And I was real nervous about thinking, doing it. And I thought a little bit about it in the background, in my head. I hadn't really thought about it. And I just sort of went in there and I did this completely new thing. And I was so, you know, I was so going on adrenaline. And it was great. And it changed the whole way that course had been taught. But then we came out in break. And there were this whole bunch of people standing out there ready to congratulate me and give me hugs, and some of the students are standing. What is going on? So that was fun. Mm-hmm. That was really, yeah. That was nice.
Now, are there other awards and honors that you'd talk about?
I mean, I would say from getting, for example, getting the Romney's Award early on was nice, because again, it was sort of saying, you're doing well. Mm-hmm. And I would say the same thing for the university professorships, the Wharf professorship and the Steenbach professorship of microbiology. Again, I got those right, I would say, right before my star was rising, or however, you know, however you'd want to say that. And so those were important to me too, and it was important that the campus, you know, the other scientists on campus sort of recognize that, you know, your work, you're doing good.
Mm-hmm.
So those were important to me. Okay. And actually, the Hilldale Award was actually very important to me. I mean, that's sort of the seal of approval in the sense that you've done good other than your science.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it came to me at a very important time, because it came to me when I just, in the process of leaving, the biomolecular chemistry and transferring over here. It was a very personal, you know, traumatic mm-hmm. Period for me, and for to have at the university, you know, a group of scientists at the university level say to give me that award was actually, I'm almost getting teary. It was very meaningful at that point in time. So that was important.
You mentioned earlier about the importance for many. Well, we were talking about women, a balance in their lives. And would you talk about the balance in your life, what you do when you're not working? Talk about your family, what your hobbies are, what you do to relax, what you do to keep healthy, to keep energetic?
Balance is hard. My kids are grown, so they're...
What do they do?
One is a lawyer who has decided he wants to live his life in Madison, which is making me very happy as a mother. And the other one is actually in Turkey right now, but he's just finishing his undergraduate work in criminal justice, which amuses me.
No scientist.
No scientist. My elder son did a high school project in the lab, and I remember that he said, I'm sorry, Mom, but this is boring. Okay. So we live close to campus.
What does your husband do?
He just retired. He was assistant state cartographer, so he's a geographer type mm-hmm. person. So he now gets to cook dinners and things.
Aren't you lucky?
Right. And so I didn't become really involved in administration, you know, to call being chair of administration, until the kids had left home. And I don't think, I couldn't possibly have, maybe I could have done it, but I wouldn't want it to have done it, because it's extremely important to me to keep an active research program, which is part of the reason I've never gone higher in administration than a department chair. And you have more flexibility when you don't have children at home, mm-hmm. obviously. Relaxing. We have a little cabin on a little lake up north, which is a wonderful retreat with no email. and we enjoy going up there very much. And mystery books, gardening, plants, as you might be able to tell.
Some plants out there.
Right, most of those
very
are mine.
Impressive.
So that's sort of how I, you know, growing plants from seed, doing all of that sort of stuff is sort of the way I, you know, relax.
Did you continue to be involved in sports?
I do. Unfortunately, I have an inner ear problem, which means that I can't do any of that anymore, but I still jog, and that's how I keep my sanity, very slowly at this point. But so I always have enjoyed, you know, being active, and it's important in sort of keeping a frame of mind.
And is that how you stay healthy, too, exercise and...
Yeah. You know. Yeah.
Get rid of the stress that way?
No, it's very important. I mean, I can go out, sometimes I go out in the morning and I come back and, you know, they're not so bad. we'll figure them out. And so, yeah, that's extremely important to my mental health. I realize that if I don't do that, all of a sudden these little things, they're not necessarily little, but I have a harder time keeping things in perspective.
Mm-hmm. How about travel?
Oh, unfortunately, my inner ear problem doesn't allow me to travel very much. So I think quite successfully developed a life that is enjoyable. And part of the reason I think I work as hard as I do is I can walk to work, and so work is really fun and keeps me occupied. I have a problem that I can't ride in a car without getting sick. So if I ride in a car, even a mile, then I feel terrible for a minimum of 4 hours and maybe 24 hours. So I have, you know, when you have chronic things, you just organize your life. And I think I've done that fairly successfully.
Any pets?
Two cats. one of which we just got from the pound a few weeks ago. So, yeah. No, I've almost always had cats and, you know, I enjoy it. And they're nice because you don't have to take care of them quite as much as you have to dogs, so you can get involved in other things.
And I have to ask this question because it's always an important one to me. You work very hard. You've raised two children. Do you have time for friends?
Sometimes. It is lonely at the top. And I think this is the thing, more than anything else, that I would say is the most difficult, has been the most difficult for me. I mean, I noticed it when I came here. I looked around, and I think one of the hardest things for assistant professors to learn is your students aren't your peers. And you're the one that's going to be writing them letters of recommendation. So I came when I was 31 or 2, and my students were 26. I mean, that would, you're the same, right?
Right.
It's the same,
right.
Right. But you're not their friend. And that's extremely lonely, especially if, you know, there aren't a lot of, I mean, you can have, I'm not saying, I have a lot of male friends, but there's something different about female friends. And so a number of them have moved away. I mean, Carol Gross and I became very good friends, and that she left for UCSF, like in the early 90s and mid-90s. And then let me tell you, it becomes much lonelier when you go from the faculty member to department chair, because, you know, you can be in a department where you've mentored many of those women and you've become very close friends, and all of a sudden, you're the one that's going to tell them what course they have to teach and get on their case when they don't do something, and it changes things dramatically. And I don't think at this moment in time, there may be one, but there's no sort of long-standing woman chair in science, or biological science. So, yeah, that's hard. Mm-hmm. That's very hard. Mm-hmm. And it's not that I don't have friends and all of that stuff, but, so I don't think, it's not as much as the time, because you can make time. Mm-hmm. It's sort of the pool.
Right. So, and what about your parents? Are they still living?
My mother is still living.
Is she in New Hampshire?
She's living in the house that I grew up in. Mm-hmm. This is starting to take more and more time because she's, you know, 88 and lives down a dirt road, and memory isn't quite as good as it used to be.
And how about your brother? Where is he?
He lives in New Hampshire. He lives about a 2.5-hour drive.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Mm-hmm. Well, that ends the formal questions, but if there's anything you'd like to add to this interview, please do.
I think the only thing that I didn't say, because we sort of changed subject, was in the teaching thing, and you started asking me about graduate students and mentoring
Yes.
graduate students. And that, to me, is one of the greatest joys, maybe also the greatest frustration, of being in this business, because the greatest joys, because there's nothing better, right, than having this student come in that really doesn't know very much, and then, you know, 5 years later, they go off into, you know, you just see the change in them, and it's night and day, and you see them in their thesis defense talking about a model or some thought they come up with that they've never told you, and they can discuss it with the rest of the faculty. You just feel so proud, you know. It can also be very frustrating because part of the job is making sure that people sort of get to the level and whatever that is best for them, and that doesn't always go easily. So that can be very difficult. But I mean, mentoring graduate students is one of the most rewarding parts of doing this.
Well, thank you very much for agreeing to interview. Much appreciate it.
You're welcome.